Well, good, beautiful day to all of you. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome. Hey, Megan and Lewis. Greetings from Ohio, David Miller says. Glad to have you with us. Good morning, Nathan and Kamal, Walter John. Hey, Rob, good afternoon. Lewis Stone says, good morning. What a blessing. 2 days in a row live instead of watching recorded. Yeah, glad to have you with us. So today is going to test some of you, pun intended. We're going to see Abraham. Well, I don't want to give it away. We're going to see what the scripture says is going on. And for some of us with our Reformed systematic theology background, the almost gravitational pull is to go a different direction from what is explicitly stated here. We come to these texts with our system, with our framework, and we so often miss what the Bible actually says. So I'm gonna hold you to it, and for some there's gonna be a couple things here that I think are gonna be really tough. At least they were tough for me years ago as I wrestled with this. As sort of a warm up, a primer here, I want to briefly comment on a comment that Peter Woods made on yesterday's video. He says, "Was this covenant in Genesis 17 a different covenant from that of Genesis 15?" Yesterday we looked at 17 and the circumcision and all that, right? He says 15 was to Abram, only for offspring and the land with no preconditions, yet 17 was to Abraham and his descendants, and the promises go beyond those of 15 and adds a condition, circumcision. Yeah, it's a good question, and one that probably we've all wrestled with, especially as we read theology. Now, I don't know all that Peter is in his background, so I'm not suggesting that that's where he's coming from. It's a reasonable question based on the text. As I think about this now, and as I move away from trying to answer questions that the Bible doesn't answer, I come with my own question to that question: does it really matter? And again, this is not, I'm not pushing back on Peter. I'm just saying, yeah, okay, the question arises, is this a separate covenant from what he said earlier? What do we make of this? And I'm just at the place now where I think it doesn't matter. It's a story. Are we supposed to define God's covenant with Abraham so narrowly in chapter 15 that we can't see chapter 17 as a continuation of the theme? Are we supposed to ask, are there different covenants here? I don't think so. It's kind of like, for any of you who are Narnia fans, does it make sense that there are two kings and two queens of Narnia? It doesn't make sense if we come to the book with a particular framework of what kings and queens are, but that's how Lewis told the story, and he had a purpose in it. And I don't think we're supposed to ask the question, is Edmund really a king if Peter is over him? So that's how I see it. I think it doesn't matter. Caitlin says, can you please speak up? I have trouble hearing you at top volume. Thank you. Is anybody else having problems? Nothing has changed to mine, and I'm getting pretty strong sound indicators here. I'm getting really strong on all my levels. So does anybody else have a different volume setting than normal? If somebody else does, then I will consider it on my end. If nobody else does, then Caitlin, I would say it's probably on your end. Good in PA. Nathan says he's good. All right. So there's a small feedback there. Good here, Rob says. Good and strong. Okay, so Caitlin, I'm going to say that's probably something on your end, not on my end. I'm speaking like I normally do, and all my settings are the same. All right. So I would just say let's look at this as the story unfolds, and we're going to, and I'm spending this much time on it now because we're going to run into the same kinds of questions here in Genesis 22 and following. So here's, so yesterday we saw finally the birth of Abraham's son through the womb of Sarah, his barren wife, his old barren wife. Finally, after years and years and years of promises, God blesses Abraham and Sarah with their own son. This is the son of promise, right? You remember we looked at this? God specifically named Isaac as the son of promise. You've got to have that clear in your mind if you're going to understand what's going on here in 22. And side note, you've got to have this in mind if you're going to understand what Romans 9 is all about. But I'm not going to go there. I did a whole series on that. The son of promise. God doesn't say, I'm going to give you a son, and if something doesn't work out there, I'll give you another son. No, no. This is the son, the way that God has bound himself to fulfilling his promise of Abraham having a multitude of descendants is through this one son, Isaac. Does everybody understand that? It's crucial to see that. If God does not fulfill his promise through Isaac, then someone may rightly question God's honor and trustworthiness because he named it specifically. With that in mind, let's look at chapter 22. Sometime after these things, God tested Abraham. You have to see that sentence to understand what's going on here. God is putting Abraham's faith and trust to the test. That's why this story is in the Bible, to show us that God was testing Abraham. He said to him, Abraham, here I am, Abraham replied. God said, take your son, your only son, whom you love, Isaac. Okay, there's no room for any mistake. This is your son. This is your only son. You love him. His name is Isaac. Take him and go to the land of Moriah. Offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains which I will indicate to you. From a systematic theology perspective, this just crashes the system. This doesn't make any sense. Is it lawful? Is it righteous for God to tell a man to burn his son on the altar? I mean, think about how much anger God has for the Israelites later when they offer their children to Moloch in the fire. Child sacrifice is displeasing to the Lord, to put it mildly. And here, God tells Abraham to put his son on the altar and offer him as a burnt offering to God. If you read this from a systematic theology perspective, you are going to start creating all kinds of explanations, qualifications, etc., etc., etc. We're not supposed to read it that way. We're supposed to read it as the story. It's kind of like someone asked me in a comment after one of the videos some time ago, not too long ago, and we'll probably get into this when we get into the Mosaic Covenant and the law and so on, but incest is strictly forbidden in the Old Covenant. But I don't think there's any way getting around the fact that Cain had to marry his sister. It doesn't work otherwise. It just logically doesn't work. We have to let the story lay out as it is. And here God is testing Abraham and says, I want you to offer him to me as a burnt offering. And Abraham is willing to do it. I won't go through the story. I love the story. It is a powerful story, but for the sake of our larger purpose here, I'm going to move on. But you know the story. He takes him and he puts Isaac on the altar and he is ready to take the knife in his hand. He has the knife in his hand. He raises it and he's ready to plunge it into the chest of Isaac. And there God cries out and says, stop. Stop. Don't touch the lad. And I want you to see. Okay, here's what he says. The angel of the Lord called to him from heaven, Abraham, Abraham, here I am, he answered. And again, Abraham has the knife in the air ready to kill his son. Do not harm the boy, the angel said. Do not do anything to him, for now I know that you fear God, because you did not withhold your son, your only son, from me. And what do theologians rush to do in this text right here? I would almost guarantee that any Reformed preacher who preaches this text, as soon as they read that verse, is going to say, now, I know that it says, now I know that you fear God. But of course, God is omniscient, and he already knew. And they're going to spend the rest of the sermon explaining how God already knew, and this didn't really give God new information. And when we do that, some of you are teachers and preachers, and I want to challenge you. When you do that, you are drawing people away from what the text actually says and what it intends to teach. You're not supposed to ask the question, did God know this already? Did he not know this? Isn't God omniscient? That's not the question you're supposed to ask. You're supposed to ask, how did Abraham pass the test? Would I pass the test? Do I trust God enough? I mean, it's unthinkable. I have a son. I love him. I can't imagine God calling me to sacrifice him. But in addition to my love for my son, if all the promises that you've been waiting for decades and decades hinged on this one young man, and now God says, kill him. Would I trust God enough to go through with it? Abraham did. In fact, the writer of Hebrews, reflecting on this, says the reason Abraham was willing to do this is because he was so committed to the trustworthiness of God at this point in his life, and he was so sure after all that he'd been through that God was going to bless him and fulfill his promises through Isaac, that he was convinced he was going to kill Isaac and God would raise him from the dead. That's how strong his faith was. We are supposed to be amazed at Abraham's faith. We're not supposed to ask the question whether or not God knew. That's not the point. Don't mislead your people and don't distract from the narrative as presented when you preach and teach these things. The angel of the Lord called to Abraham a second time from heaven and said, I solemnly swear by my own name, decrees the Lord, that because you have done this and have not withheld your son, your only son, I will indeed bless you. And I will greatly multiply your descendants so that they will be as countless as the star in the sky or the grains of sand on the seashore. Your descendants will take possession of the strongholds of their enemies. Because you have obeyed me, all the nations of the earth will pronounce blessings on one another using the name of your descendants. These two occurrences of the word because are in the Hebrew text. And they mean what they sound like they mean. Because you obeyed me. Again, our systems of theology drive such a wedge between obedience and faith that most teachers will spend their lessons, their sermons, their Sunday school classes explaining how God is not blessing Abraham because of his obedience, even though that's exactly what the text says, that God's blessing him because of his obedience. Don't be like those guys. Preach the text. teach the text. Believe the text. God tested Abraham. Abraham passed the test. And now God says, because you've done this, I will fulfill all of my promises to you. That's how it's given to us. All right. So there is so much more, and I'm tempted to keep walking through Genesis because there's some great stuff, and it's important and it matters. But for our purposes of New Covenant theology, I'm going to leave Abraham there. I'm going to summarize the fact, and you know this probably, but so we've got Isaac here, right? Isaac has a son, Jacob. He actually has two sons. They're twins, Jacob and Esau. But Jacob is the chosen one. And Jacob has 12 sons, and they become the heads of the tribes of Israel. We call the 12 tribes of Israel, which becomes the great nation of Israel. All right, so the family tree of blessing. Remember, Abraham had other sons. He had Ishmael, we already saw. And the text goes on to say he had other sons and daughters. But the promise, or the promises that God made to Abraham, are all going to go through Isaac and through Jacob, not Esau. And then Jacob has the 12. Jacob says, does this story prove spanking is sinful because God stopped before he hit him? No, it most certainly does not prove that. All right, so Peter says, why do you think God tested Abraham in this way if the covenant was unconditional? I don't know. I have to ask God sometime. All right, so at the end of Genesis, we have the 12 sons of Jacob in Egypt. Then Exodus begins with this. These are the names of the sons of Israel. Remember, Jacob's name was changed to Israel. These are the names of the sons of Israel who entered Egypt. Each man with his household entered with Jacob. Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and goes through the 12 names. All the people who were directly descended from Jacob numbered 70. So when the 12 sons of Jacob, the 12 sons of Israel, go down to Egypt, at the end of Genesis, there are 70 of them. Joseph was already in Egypt, and in the time of Joseph and his brothers and all that generation died. The Israelites, however, were fruitful, increased greatly, multiplied, and became extremely strong so that the land was filled with them. Why do we have this paragraph here? See these key words, fruitful, multiply, greatly increased. These are all reminders of the promises God gave to Abraham. Your offspring, your descendants can be a great nation. You'll increase, you'll multiply, all that. What's happening? Between the end of Genesis 50 and Exodus 1, 400 years have passed. We know that from other texts of Scripture. And God has fulfilled his promise to Abraham that his descendants will become a great nation and increase and multiply. That's what we see here. Then a new king who did not know Joseph came up to power over Egypt. He said to his people, look at the Israelite people, more numerous and stronger than we are. So he's saying, look, these Israelites outnumber us and they're stronger. Come, let's deal wisely with them. Otherwise, they will continue to multiply. And if a war breaks out, they will ally themselves with our enemies and fight against us and leave the country. So all these comments here at the beginning of Exodus to show us God did exactly what he said he would do. All right. So then as the story goes on, God raises up Moses, and he goes and does the 10 plagues, leads the people out of slavery to Pharaoh in Egypt, through the Red Sea, all those stories that we know. I want to spend the rest of our time this morning on Exodus 16. Okay, so they've left Egypt. They left with great wealth. And they've seen God do amazing things, all 10 plagues and the parting of the Red Sea, powerful stuff. They should be greatly trusting in this God who delivered them and did all these things. And if they remembered the promise to Abraham, they should be expecting great things. But we'll see a different story here. When they journeyed from Elim, the entire company of Israelites came to the wilderness of Sin, which doesn't have anything to do with the word sin, like disobedience, which is between Elim and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month after their exodus from the land of Egypt. The entire company of Israelites murmured against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. The Israelites said to them, "If only we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the pots of meat, when we ate bread to the full, for you have brought us out into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger." So we're getting a good sense of who these Israelites are. They're grumbling, complaining, sort of dismissing what God has done. They want to eat, and they think they're going to starve to death. Then the Lord said to Moses, "I am going to rain bread from heaven for you, and the people will go out and gather the amount for each day so that I may test them. Will they walk in my law or not?" Okay, we're going to see this, and it's important to understand. Theologians create all their purposes for the law. Here's why God gave the law to Israel. And they import their, you know, their tripartite division and their purposes and so on. Here is the way God says, or the purpose God says, at least in this text, as to why he's going to give them the law. To test them. Are they going to obey him or not? Just like he tested Abraham. Are you going to do what I tell you to do or not? We've got to let the scripture tell us what the purpose of God's commands are, not our theologians. On the sixth day, they will prepare what they bring in, and it'll be twice as much as they gather every other day. Okay, so he's going to give them bread from heaven, and they're going to collect it on 6 days. But on the sixth day, they will bring in twice as much as they do any other day. So 1 through 5, you gather this much. On day 6, you gather twice as much. So you gather your daily bread on the first 5 days. And then on the sixth day, you do twice your daily bread. Moses and Aaron said to all the Israelites, "In the evening you will know the Lord has brought you out of the land of Egypt, and in the morning you'll see the glory of the Lord, because he has heard your murmurings against the Lord. As for us, what are we that you should murmur against us?" Moses is taking this personally. Why are you griping at me and Aaron? Moses said, "You will know this when the Lord gives you meat to eat in the evening and bread in the morning to satisfy you. Because the Lord has heard your murmurings, that you are murmuring against him. As for us, what are we? Your murmurings are not against us, but against the Lord." Look, the Lord's going to show himself. He's going to display his glory and his power and his care for you. He's going to give you food. He's heard your grumbling. He's going to give you food. You don't even have to work for it. You just got to go collect it. Then Moses said to Aaron, "Tell the whole community of the Israelites, come before the Lord, because he's heard your murmurings." How many times has Moses written the word murmurings here in this section? That's a key point. They are grumblers, and God doesn't like grumbling. As Aaron spoke to the whole community of the Israelites, and they looked toward the wilderness, there the glory of the Lord appeared in the cloud, and the Lord spoke to Moses. "I have heard the murmurings of the Israelites." There it is again. "Tell them, during the evening you will eat meat, in the morning you will be satisfied with bread, so that you may know that I am the Lord your God. I'm testing you to see if you'll obey me. I'm blessing you to see if you will acknowledge that I provide for you and stop your grumbling. In the evening, the quail came up and covered the camp. In the morning, a layer of dew was all around the camp. When the layer of dew had evaporated, there on the surface of the wilderness was a thin, flaky substance, thin like frost of the earth. When the Israelites saw it, they said to one another, 'What is it?' because they didn't know what it was. Moses said, 'It is the bread that the Lord has given you for food.'" Why? We already know why. To test them. This is what the Lord has commanded. "Each person is to gather it from it what he can eat, an omer per person according to the number of your people. Each one will pick it up for whoever lives in his tent." All right. So men, count how many people are in your tent. Take an omer per person. Go out and collect it every day. One omer per person in your household. The Israelites did so, and they gathered some more, some less. Why? Because they have different numbers of people in their tents. When they measured with an omer, the one who gathered much had nothing left over, and the one who gathered little lacked nothing. Each one had gathered what he could eat. It was the perfect amount to fill them. Moses said to them, no one is to keep any of it until morning. So go collect all that you need according to the measurement and eat it all. But they did not listen to Moses. Some kept part of it until morning, and it was full of worms and began to stink. And Moses was angry with them. It's a simple test. Just go out and collect this much for each person and eat it all. That's the simple test, right? Don't eat of that tree. It's a simple test. But they didn't pass. They were not like Father Abraham. Some of them decided not to eat. Presumably, now I don't know for sure, but it seems like they're thinking maybe there's not going to be another provision tomorrow, so I'm going to save a little for tomorrow. Whether that's the motive or not, doesn't matter. They didn't obey. Next morning, it is full of worms and stinks. So they gathered it each morning, each person according to what he could eat, and when the sun got hot, it would melt. On the sixth day, they gathered twice as much food, two omers per person, and all the leaders of the community came and told Moses. He said to them, this is what the Lord had said. Tomorrow is a time of cessation from work, a holy Sabbath to the Lord. Whatever you want to bake, bake today. Whatever you want to boil, boil today. Whatever is left, put aside for yourselves to be kept until morning. Wait a minute, what? They did that. They kept stuff till the morning, and it was filled with worms and stank. And now on the sixth day, Moses tells them, take twice as much and keep a portion of it for tomorrow. Well, that seems crazy. It's just going to stink, isn't it? It's going to get filled with maggots. So they put it aside until the morning, just as Moses had commanded, and it did not stink, nor were there any worms in it. Moses said, eat it today, for today is a Sabbath to the Lord. Today you will not find it in the area. 6 days you will gather it, but on the seventh day, the Sabbath, there will not be any. On the seventh day, some of the people went out to gather it, but they found nothing. He told them, don't gather anything on the seventh day. Some of them went out to gather on the seventh day, and there wasn't anything. The Lord said to Moses, how long do you refuse to obey my commandments and my instructions? See, because the Lord has given you the Sabbath, that is why he's given you food for 2 days on the sixth day. Each of you stay where you are. Let no one go out of his place on the seventh day. So the people rested on the seventh day. What's God doing? He's setting up here at the beginning of his relationship with the Israelites. He is showing them they are a wicked, hard-hearted, desirous people who simply chase after their own appetites, and they refuse to obey God. And sadly, that's going to be their testimony through most of their history. They are not like Father Abraham. That's the point of the story. We are told why this is here. God's testing them. He's exposing their lack of trust. Dale says, didn't the Old Testament covenants operate on a physical level primarily? Physical as opposed to what? Spiritual? Physical as opposed to what? So far, all the promises are temporal, right? They all have to do with property and biological offspring. And that kind of thing. So, Dale, what would be, if that's what you mean by physical, yes. Dean Floyd says, Esau allowed for more grace and forgiveness than Jacob did during their last encounter. Yeah, maybe. Jacob was not the paragon of virtue, that's for sure. It wasn't until the end, you know, when he wrestled with God. I think that's an easy story to misunderstand. That's when Jacob finally became a man and stood up and tried to protect his people. Anyway, I got to be careful. I'll head on down that path, and that's not why we're here. Is this why in John Christ says, if you believed Moses, you'd believe me? Christ was like Moses, but Israel wanted bread rather than life. Yeah, the Jews of Jesus' day did exactly the same thing the Jews of Moses' day did. Yeah, precisely. And Stephen, for instance, in Acts 7, lays that out. It said, you're just like the fathers. You're faithless, and you're driven by your own desires and so on. All right, so God put Israel to the test. They failed the test. And now we're setting up for the ultimate test as he enters into covenant with them. Again, this is how we have to read the scripture. Put away your theology books. Put away your commentaries. Read the texts and let the texts say what they say. It's a story. And be careful about going beyond what is revealed and written, trying to answer questions the Bible doesn't answer or that they're not intended to answer. We know the theme of this. It all points to Jesus, and that's what we're looking for. How does Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Moses and the people of Israel and the law and all these things, how do they apply to Jesus? How do they prepare for Jesus? How do they prefigure Jesus? All those things as we see. All right, leave it there. We'll come back tomorrow and continue down this path. Grace and peace to you all. God bless.